Why are Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands still waiting for FEMA support 2 years after Hurricanes Irma and Maria? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. A New York Times report sifted through tons of FEMA data, and they found that cities in the U.S. territories received far less financial support after the hurricanes than did U.S. cities on the mainland. We'll try and understand why. Also, there are no longer financial incentives to make movies in Florida, but that didn't stop the creators of the new film, Waves. It's the story of an African-American family dealing with issues of loss and drug addiction.
Just in love with it. And, you know, to me, the movie's about love and the highs and lows and everything in between.
Finally, we're going to look at an art project that tells the history of Liberty City through virtual reality, and one that focuses on abandoned cars in the Everglades. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. Hurricane season ended on Saturday, and for South Florida this year, we were lucky. We know what it's like to take a hit, and we know how long the recovery process can take. And usually, we recover fairly quickly. Not so in Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands. In those places, there are roads that remain impassable, homes that have been abandoned, and even places like schools that are battling mold. So where is the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, to help? Zolan Cano-Youngs is a reporter for the New York Times. He, along with reporter Mark Walker, recently examined the funding delays for restoration projects in those U.S. territories. Cano-Youngs joins us now from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Mr. Cano-Youngs, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
What was your understanding about the continued struggles in places like Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands going into this investigation? I mean, how much did we know about the damage that still remains?
Well, I think before we really started digging into this, what we did know is, I mean, there was a lot of political rhetoric. Right. I mean, we heard what was coming from the White House, what White House officials said about these places being corrupt and that being a primary reason why there were funding delays. But, you know, even through that, we would still see these images and kind of story by story saying that contractors that were tasked with, you know, rebuilding hospitals and schools still hadn't been paid, that, you know, students going to school were still struggling as well, that those schools were still struggling. And we got to a point, Mark Walker and myself, where we were thinking, you know, how many disasters have passed since Hurricane Maria and Irma? You know, we have had flooding in Houston. We've seen more hurricanes hit in Florida and North Carolina. And it can be very easy to kind of focus on each of these new incidents and look past those devastating hurricanes from more than 2 years ago. So that was really the motivation going in. We knew that problems still persisted and that recovery efforts had stalled. But we want to know to what extent and also why. And also, is it really just corruption that's the primary factor in the disparity in the pace of recovery when it comes to the mainland and the islands? Yeah. Those were kind of the questions that we had going in.
I mean, look, Florida has taken its hits of hurricanes over the decades, and recovery could take a while. But for the most part, we come back pretty quickly. What we've seen in Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands is unimaginable. You know, that there are places that still look like they just got hit, and it's been 2 years. All the people that you and Mark spoke to, I'm wondering, what were people saying about what they believe are the reasons why it's taken so long?
Well, it differs depending on who you're talking to, which I'm sure, you know, you could expect for something like this. You talk to people on the ground, and I mean, these are the people that, you know, these are the nurses that walk into a hospital that still has holes in the roof, that, you know, has a floor that's been completely shut down still more than 2 years later because of mold, and who are, you know, ignoring their own skin rashes as a result of that mold as they go to work. They see what's happening on the ground, and they feel, and I'm speaking for both for both islands at this point, the Virgin Islands and for Puerto Rico.
Right.
You know, our reporting showed when we would talk to them, they would always say, well, look, you know, we are being neglected. We are not represented in Washington. We do not have a say. When you only have one representative in the case of the Virgin Islands, they were saying, you know, we're not going to have as much political pull. Now, when you talk to FEMA officials, former and current, it gets a bit more nuanced. I mean, they point to a system, and not just FEMA, but also GAO officials. They would point to their system. And FEMA would say, look, we're a reimbursement system. That's how disaster relief funds get down to people on the ground.
And by the way, GAO, just to remind us.
Oh, I apologize. That would be the Government Accountability Office.
Thank you.
Tasked with oversight of agencies such as FEMA. So you talk to FEMA officials, and they would constantly remind you, we are a reimbursement system. That's how disaster relief works. You know, it's up to the localities, whether it be a state or a territory, to start the process of recovery, to front those costs. And then we come in and we reimburse for their efforts. But the more you dig into that, when you dig into the data and you talk to some of those GAO officials and other even former FEMA officials, it gets a bit more complicated. I mean, for one, it's not easy for these places in the Caribbean to front the costs for a variety of reasons. These are places where their economies just can't keep up with the states, especially when it comes to disasters, as a result of the disasters. I mean, in the case of the Virgin Islands, you have an economy that's very much centered on tourism. And what happens when a hurricane comes? That tourism industry is dismantled. So how can you generate enough revenue to front costs for recovery in that way? There's also other reasons as well. So we've already established that the states and places in the mainland might be able to front costs, might have more charities, more organizations that can help them with recovery before the reimbursement funds come in. But these places have also, our reporting showed, been caught up in a bit of the Trump administration political era, this administration's era of politics.
So I wanted to come back because looking at the information right now, Puerto Rico so far has gotten $14 billion. They're supposed to get another $91 billion, but that over a couple of decades. I wanted to get an understanding of how FEMA decides on what projects get, you know, assistance. Because as you said, they usually let the localities start the process and then they reimburse. But how do they even decide which ones we're going to reimburse? Because I want to know, the discrepancy between why Houston or Miami would get, you know, assistance in different projects. And they've gotten most of the assistance they've asked for. But places in Puerto Rico and St. Croix, they're still waiting.
That's right. And it's important to remember that for our story, we focused as well on critical infrastructure projects. So, you know, for a lot of these other places, I mean, when your listeners kind of see the blue tarp go out in a lot of those emergency programs, that's a separate project in itself, that kind of first responder assistance that FEMA will provide. We want to focus on critical infrastructure, that being schools and hospitals. And what you saw this, for a while, there were certain rules in place on whether or not FEMA would decide to provide money to rebuild or provide money to completely reconstruct a facility. So that's one reason right here. And when you, and the way that rule worked is, say you had a hospital, like in St. Croix, you have that hospital that I just described. Basically, the Virgin Islands was tasked with, well, one, that hospital was decimated. So the Virgin Islands goes to FEMA and they say, look, this hospital needs to be reconstructed. Now we hit a first roadblock because FEMA would say, well, look, what percentage of the damage was caused by the disaster? The Virgin Islands would say, well, look, you know, it may be this percentage, it may be that percentage, but in order for us to be resilient going forward, we need to rebuild this whole thing, or else it's just going to be reconstructed in a faulty way.
So FEMA is basically saying, you know, how much of the damage was the hurricane, and how much of it is you just wanting to rebuild a hospital?
Yes. Or how much of the damage was caused by the hurricane and how much of it are you just trying to reconstruct to be better? That's how it worked before this year, right? And what that was a source for much of the delay, because that was they were just they collided on that. They debated over that, and until they got to an agreement, they were you didn't see any money hit the ground for that hospital.
Right.
But some of that changed earlier this year, I have to add. So after a, you know, more than a year, Congress then basically changed the rules. Allow, and this is important, change the rules allowing FEMA to waive that requirement. That happened all the way in the start of the year with the Bipartisan Budget Relief Act. But still, it took more than 6 months in order for any agreement to take place. So you're seeing that delay just right there. FEMA had the ability at that point to waive the 50% rule,
yeah,
and go ahead and say, we're going to completely rebuild this thing. But it's still, but there was still a delay.
Right. I'm talking with New York Times reporter Zolan Cano Youngs. He, along with reporter Mark Walker, recently examined the two-year wait for Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands, the wait they've been experiencing in getting FEMA funding for recovery projects after Hurricanes Maria and Irma. By the way, you can read the story on their social media, on our social media at WLRN Sundial. So Cano Youngs, you said, depending on who you talk to, they'll tell you mm-hmm. a different story. Mm-hmm. What do folks in Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands think is the problem? Is it FEMA? Do they think it's the President of the United States? You know, and again, we hear from people on the territories, they believe generally that they don't get treated the same way, even though they're U.S. citizens.
That's right. That's right. Some feel that they are being neglected because they are not quote-unquote states. Others feel that, listen to the president's comments and feel that they would not be treated the same as somebody in the mainland. Others point to the fact that these are places with a majority of people of color. There are some in the territories that also look to their local governments. And I saw this in St. Croix. You know, I talked to some officials who said, look, you know, we had never experienced something like this. And there were, you know, you need certain paperwork to submit and a certain level of organization that was impossible because many of our own employees were fleeing because of the disaster. So that was a struggle, just to add a little bit of nuance there. But I want to go one thing that many people in the territories would often point to is the president's comments where he would say, look, these places have been plagued by corruption. When you dig into the numbers, it just doesn't hold up. That just doesn't hold up as a primary reason of this disparity. Because let's, for one, corruption is nothing new when it comes to disaster relief. You know, we can go back to Hurricane Katrina when it comes.
In New Orleans, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. There were incidents involving corruption there. And, I mean, even in a place, you know, like Texas, we looked at some of the arrest records, some of the actual records for corrupt cases. And in Texas, it actually outweighed the territories there. So it just doesn't hold up when you look at that. And I think people in the territories see that and they look at the president's comments. And then all they can think of is that they're being neglected because they are not in the mainland. Just to read one stat to you, you know, White House aides point to 375 public corruption convictions between 2008 and 2017. But that was mostly as a result of one federal investigation into its police force in Puerto Rico. That same time period, Texas had almost 1,000 public corruption convictions. So does that really hold up as a primary reason?
One of the things I remember reading a lot about, especially in 2017, I mean, you had Irma, you had Maria, you had wildfires, that FEMA felt pressed, that there were a lot of disasters and there was a lot of need. But again, I just wanted to come back to this idea that did FEMA put more focus on U.S. cities in the mainland, like Houston, and not as much on the U.S. territories?
I'm not sure if I could say that it's a matter of focus, but when you come to these long-term projects, it is apparent based off of the data and the interviews that we have parsed through, as well as the policies that were put in place, in which government officials said that those policies were mostly for oversight for the territories, that there was more wariness and on the part of FEMA when it came to providing this relief for the territories as a result of their allegations, that being the administration's allegations of corruption in those territories. They put in place a more complex process with what they would say had mechanisms of oversight, with what people in the territories would say were roadblocks in the territories. And it stems to the allegations of corruptions on the part of the administration. Those roadblocks just don't seem to be there, be present, or be causing as much delays in the states.
What do we know about the people, you know, in the stories that you had highlighted, these folks on the islands? What's happening to them now? Are they able to get any of the things they need, especially medical care?
You know, it really spoke, speaking of medical care, I want to relay one anecdote. You know, in St. Croix, they recently had a shooting, and it's the one hospital on the island, the one that I keep coming back to. And they brought all the victims there, and a generator that's responsible for, you know, powering much of the scanners that they have in this hospital that was damaged during the hurricane ended up just turning off. So now their scanners don't work. As a result of the mold on that floor, shutting down entire floor and shutting down all but one operating room, there were gunshot victims that were now being treated and waiting on stretchers in the hallways of the hospitals, not even in a room. And eventually many of these victims were going to be flown off of the hospital to get to another place where they could be treated. And here's the thing. In the past, that place might have been Puerto Rico, but things aren't much better there. So that just gives you an idea in terms of medical care. You know, it spoke volumes when I spoke to those workers and those nurses, when I must say they were actually very optimistic and even hopeful, because finally, after I told you about how Congress passed that change regarding that 50% rule and how after all this disagreement with FEMA, they've now started to come to an agreement on recovery for their temporary facility. These nurses were excited because the temporary facility made of about 6 or 7 trailers in a row where they would be treating patients was now just starting to be built. That's what gave them optimism. And that's not scheduled to be completed until near, just around next hurricane season. And we're not even talking about the replacement facility.
An amazing story. 2 years past these hurricanes, still so much work to be done. Again, New York Times reporter Zolan Cano Youngs. Youngs worked with Mark Walker recently on a 2-year wait, looking at the 2-year wait in Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands in getting FEMA funding. We have that story on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Cano Youngs, thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it.
Hey, thank you so much. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, still to come, we spoke with the director of the new movie Waves. It's all about South Florida, and it was filmed here in South Florida. We'll have more on that coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. You've probably taken the drive across one of South Florida's causeways, right? Blasting the music, the windows are down, your hair is flowing, and on both sides, you got that deep blue water. This is the opening scene of the new film, Waves. It follows a black family who on the outside appear like any other family. Then tragedy strikes, and they're forced to deal with loss, drug addiction, and familial strife. The movie was completely filmed in South Florida, and it tries to capture the essence of this place. There are shots of swimming manatees, palm trees, beaches, and drives down US 1. The film stars Sterling K. Brown from the hit television show This Is Us, and it's generating a lot of excitement from critics. Trey Edward Schultz is the director, and he joined us a couple of weeks ago to talk about why he wanted to tell this story. Let's start with where this movie begins. We meet Tyler Williams. He's our main character, and his girlfriend, Alexis. They're driving down one of these causeways. It is that perfect Florida day, and just the perfect weather, the beautiful blue water on both sides. Tell me a little bit about this scene, why you wanted to open with this.
Yeah, I hope it captures a lot of things. One is it's their relationship. I think part of what this movie is about is love, love between loved ones, between parent and child, between lovers, siblings, all that good stuff. And I kind of wanted to drop you in a car between two people that loved each other and spin between their bodies, because that's kind of how love can feel. It can be the most exciting, freeing thing. It can be scary. It can be, it's a range, you know? So I just wanted to kind of drop you into these people's world, you know, and just spin with them for a second and then play catch up from there.
You're from Houston.
Yes.
You live in Central Florida though now.
Indeed.
Why South Florida?
Yeah.
Why was this that setting the best place for this film?
I lived in Texas all my life till I moved to Florida, and we lived all through Broward, Davie, Fort Lauderdale, Hollywood. That's where my girlfriend lived all her life. That's where her family is. Live in Orlando now, but there's a lot of things. One, I'm just in love with it. I love it, and you know, to me, the movie's about love and the highs and lows and everything in between.
What is the one thing though you could say that you love most about it?
It's the energy, man. It's just like an overall, when I'm there, it's a spirit. You know what I mean? Like, I walk around and I feel inspired. It's that simple.
What was it like filming in South Florida, though?
Unbelievable. It was so much fun. It was the best summer of my life. You know, we had hard, stressful times, but also felt really supported. And it felt like, you know, since we lost the incentive and, like, less things are shot here, and especially, I think, in Broward, too, you know, like, it was just amazing. And doing all this car work and everything we had to do, it gelled. It felt really fantastic. And it was like one of the best summers weather-wise I'd ever seen in South Florida. Like, it was not crazy tropical. Because, you know, you get terrified with continuity for these movies.
Yeah. And you talk about the incentives, the film incentives that Florida no longer offers.
Exactly.
Yeah. Who is Tyler Williams?
He's that's a complex question because he has a very complex arc. I think he's a good kid with a good family that has to go through a lot in this movie, and his life kind of dismantles in a very sad way.
He's a high school student. You know, as you said, that, I mean, they come from a family. They live in a very nice neighborhood,
beautiful,
very nice house.
Yep.
He's a high school wrestler.
Yes.
Were you?
I was, so I have the scars on my shoulder from it too, from tearing my shoulder.
Is that why you wanted to put him in that situation? Because you understood that world?
Yeah, absolutely. And aspects of it were very collaborative with the lead actor, Calvin, who plays Tyler. But it was like finding a common ground. Like, for him, it was music. For me, it was wrestling. And I related to a lot of family dynamics, a lot of the pressures with school, pressures with wrestling, that way of life and the structure. So yeah, like, a lot of the movie has a lot of real life stuff in it.
All the relationships the characters have with each other, but the relationship he has with his father, Ronald.
Yeah.
You know, over the years, I mean, as when I was working as a sports reporter, I'd seen these stories of fathers who press their sons.
Yeah.
But how would you describe that relationship?
Absolutely.
Between those two? Because he had a sister, but yeah, his father didn't treat his sister the same way he treated him.
No. And it's a pressure. It's like you said, it's not just wrestling. It's a way of life. It's about being the best. And it's a big part of that, too, was collaborating with Kel and talking about the relationship with his father. For them, it was music. But it's about that way out. It's about that being the best among everything, and especially for a black father and son, and those pressures in that world of exceptionalism, you know. And it's in a lot of it is what that father's passing down from his generation, what he had to go through and coming down to his son.
There is this great scene where you see the tension between the two, and let's take a listen.
We talked about this, bro. If you can't keep it going, you can forget about hanging out with your friends or running around with that little girl of yours. Quit shaking your head at me, boy. This is my house. If you don't like the way I run things, then you can be about. I told you, you didn't have to work for me and you didn't have to train with me. You asked for that. That was your choice, right? And I'm not the one who chose wrestling, but if you go and do something, you might as well do it right. I said it before, I'll say it again. The world don't give about you or me. We are not afforded the luxury of being average. Gotta work 10 times as hard just to get anywhere. I don't push you because I want to. I push you because I have to.
Is Ronald a good father, or is he the villain, sort of?
Ooh, I don't. I try to make movies with no villains. I just try to make them with human beings that are complex. You know, we have good and bad in all of us. So, what I think, my theory on Ronald, I think he's a great dad, but I think he loves too hard. I think he loves too hard, and that energy can get channeled wrong at times. And the biggest problem is not allowing an open line of communication with his son.
What made Ronald what he is?
His past. I think how he grew up, how he had to bring this family together. You know, we also find out information of what happened to their biological mother. And you got to think how he was a single father for a time. And you also got to think about, you know, they're upper middle class. Look at their neighborhood. Look at their house. Look at everything he's had to go through to get to this moment. So that's why I think everything's led through love. He's just trying to build his son to be as strong as he can for this hard world.
And at that moment, you get the sense, because this is where race comes in, because Absolutely. He's reminding him that, you know, as a black man, you're going to have to work a lot harder than everybody else. You're going to be judged differently. I'm talking with Trey Edward Schultz. He's the director and writer of the new movie, Waves. It's the story of a middle-class black family in South Florida, and it deals with subjects of fatherhood, race, loss, and love. There will be screenings across South Florida starting December 6th, and you can find more information at WLRN.org. This is a story of a black family in going through this experience. You're not black.
I know.
Okay. So, but I wondered, like, how did the actors react to you about the story you're trying to tell, but you don't have that perspective?
It was everything because of Kel. So, like, Kel, who plays Tyler, the lead actor, we met on my last movie about a year prior to this. We loved each other, wanted to make something together again. I had aspects of this brewing, you know, aspects are very, very personal to myself. And I was like, well, I have these ideas for this other film. Maybe we can figure out this together and tailor it for you. So about a year later, I started writing, and we were basically doing these like mini therapy sessions, we call them. And I was just trying to understand his past. We were talking about both our pasts, you know, relationship with fathers, mothers, families, school pressures, and understanding the commonalities in our experience and specific differences.
Yeah. How did you approach this film focused on race and people of color, though?
In that collaboration, you know what I'm saying? So, like, understanding, like, listening and understanding, and it continued. Like, Kel got a script 8 months before we started shooting. We'd talk through everything, and I'd get his perspective. And even this scene that we're playing here, so much of that is from him and his father.
How did you get the buy-in from, like, Sterling K. Brown? How did you get them to buy in and say, yes, we like what you got going on?
Because so basically I sent a script, and Sterling loved it and figured I was black, especially because he's like, Brother Trey. He's like, I don't know a lot of white people with the name Trey. And then he even talked to me on the phone and wasn't sure because I had a deeper voice. And then he was like, wait a second.
He meets you and realizes.
Well, he looked me up after, I think. And then, you know, it was about explaining really how this all fully came to be, you know, and the unorthodox nature. And then he was like, okay, I got to meet Kelvin to make sure this is legit, you know. And he did, and they hit it off.
Let's talk about what's happening to Tyler as we go through this first act of the movie. You know, because another thing that jumped out to me was this, the communication gap between parents and their kids.
Absolutely.
And here you have a father pushing his son to be the best he can be, and his son is a wrestler, but his son also has an injury.
Yeah.
And he finds out from a doctor that, well, this is pretty much it for you.
Yeah.
But he doesn't say anything to anybody.
Absolutely.
Does he do it out of fear? Is he afraid to tell his parents?
Absolutely.
What, because he'd disappoint them or something?
I think it's disappointment. I think it's, we get a sense of it in that scene and the pressures that he feels from his father and the expectation in the highest level. And I think also for mom, it's totally different. For his stepmom in the movie, it's, he's the golden child and it's like a pure love, but it's like the fear of that disappointment can still be extremely high. And I think you could take the first half of this movie and see it as a cautionary tale on lack of communication and how that can build down these relationships between parents and children, and also I think between lovers, you know, with his girlfriend, and how that communication gets twisted. And then it's almost like you could take the second half of the film, and for me it's like working on communication and building to like huge scene in the movie that's kind of the heartbeat of the film is literally all about communication between father and daughter.
Let's take a listen to a clip from the film. Ronald the father is speaking with his daughter, Emily.
I I just wanted to apologize. I feel like we haven't spoken in some time, and I'm responsible for that. Well, I don't even really know what's going on with you. How you doing with everything?
I'm good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You know, it's okay if you're not. You can tell me anything. You know that, right?
Yeah, I know.
I worry about you.
Dad, you don't need to worry about me.
Okay.
Okay, I'm fine.
All right, all right.
How are you doing with everything?
Me? It's been hard, hasn't it?
As I said, this is a movie that really comes in two acts, and I don't want to give anything away, but, you know, the first act ends, and you get the sense, like, that in of itself is a film, but then all of a sudden we come into act two, and now we're getting to know his sister, Emily. Tell us about her and her relationship to her brother and to her parents.
Yeah.
Who is she?
She's,
because I mean, literally, you'd almost never see her or hear from her.
Amen.
In the first act,
she's in the shadows. She's the, you know, Tyler's the star child of this family, and she's the girl that gets left behind a bit. And she really is in the shadows, and she becomes the heart and soul of this movie in a really, really beautiful way.
But she struggles a lot afterwards. It's watching what's happening to her parents.
Yeah.
She finds herself in a relationship, and. And she cannot seem to forgive her brother for what he did.
Yeah. A huge part of her journey, you know. I think a big thing about this movie, too, with that path and what happens, we get to live it with Tyler. So hopefully we get to understand it. Because our movie's about empathy, really, and about understanding how we can get to that level. She doesn't. And she sees it. She has a different point of view and sees it objectively, like a lot of the world in this sense in this movie. So she has to go on an internal path of trying to heal and trying to understand how to forgive, you know, I think especially at that age and especially with a complex relationship. But that's a big part of it. Her whole trajectory is really, it's trying to heal and learn to love herself again. I think it's forgiving her brother, but also forgiving herself for certain things, you know?
Something else that jumped out at me too, again, saying this is two acts, two movies, but the first one to me almost seemed to focus a lot on a toxic masculinity.
Sure.
And the second one was more about the feminine power of empathy.
Amen. Absolutely. I think you could also take this movie in dichotomies, you know, good and bad of a human being, of a family, highs and lows of life, love, everything in between, masculine and feminine. You know, that's why it's literally split into two point of views. And first, it's a brother and a masculine point of view. And the second story, it's a woman and the sister's point of view. And I think it's just trying to make a movie about examining real people and real relationships and letting the theme come out of that.
How does that play into the title?
You know, it's waves, it's highs and lows, you know, it's the ebb and flow. For me, it's life and how we're all connected to the good and bad of the human experience, you know, so it's really thematic for me.
Trey, it was a lovely film. I really appreciate the time.
Thank you so much.
This
was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And that was my conversation with Trey Edward Schultz, the director of the new film Waves. It starts screening in South Florida this week, December 6th. You can learn more about Waves at WLRN.org. Still to come, we're going to meet two artists who are going to show us places here in South Florida from perspectives you wouldn't expect. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. The 2019 Night Arts Challenge winners have been announced. This yearly contest awards South Florida artists and community leaders with a total of $1.8 million to bring the region's residents together through the arts. Two of this year's winners, Katia Esan and Charles J. Kropke, they join me now in studio. Esan's project is about the history of Liberty City through virtual reality. That's interesting. And Kropke's brings to life photos that he's taken of abandoned vehicles in the Everglades, things we probably pass by, we don't even think about. Kropke, by the way, has worked in Everglades restoration for years as part of the Everglades restoration movement. Again, they both join me in studio now. It is such a pleasure. By the way, congratulations to both of you. This is huge, but congrats.
It is huge.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to learn about both of your projects. Katya, let me start with you. This essentially started as a documentary film, right?
Yes. I've been filming a documentary for 2.5 years now, basically focusing on the transformation of Liberty Square and, of course, the surrounding Liberty City. And while I was doing that, I met so many incredibly elders and living legends, icons, that shared their memories of Liberty City and Liberty Square when it was still in its golden age, so to speak. Beautiful memories that they had as children and growing up. And since I knew I would never be able to put that all into the documentary, we were always trying to think what could be another possible way to capture and then, you know, share these memories. So we came up with a virtual reality journey that will travel through time.
Okay, so take us through, how will I get to, as just an appreciator of art, be able to experience this? Is it like on my phone and I can virtual reality, or is there going to be somewhere an exhibit that I'm going to go to? How will I experience this?
I hope all of that. Okay. I hope it will be on the phone. It will be available as a screen version. Of course, it will be in these wonderful glasses that you put on your face, so you have it really in 3D. You know, the beauty for me is also that the plan is when the documentary is done in 2020, you know, which then will travel, you know, nationally and internationally, we can take that piece, the virtual reality piece, with us. So Liberty City will travel with us, you know, and people can experience it everywhere.
You have some history, you know, here in South Florida and with Liberty City, even though you've been working on this for a couple of years. This goes back for you quite a ways.
Yes. I came to this country from Germany to study film and theater at the University of Miami. And my big claim to fame is my first unpaid job was a production assistant at Two Live Crews Videos, which we filmed in Liberty City. And that was, I will never forget that. That was amazing.
What an interesting way to be introduced to a community, a Two Live Crew Video. And just why virtual reality? Why did you want to go that route?
Because the memories of these elders are so vividly now in my mind, also the way that they are describing it, you know, ice, you know, skating every Christmas down a certain road, that I just wanted to create something where the viewer can experience that as well.
More than just see it. Charles, you've been involved in the Everglades in so many different ways for a long, long period of time. My understanding is this project kind of happened while you were doing other work in the Everglades, right?
That's right, Lewis. First of all, I have to say that I'm not the only winner on my team. I actually couldn't take a photograph if it were my life would depend on it. My business partner in this project is photographer Matt Stock. So he takes the photographs. I conceived of the idea. And I was noticing that there were a lot of vehicles from all different eras and epochs that were out there. And to me, they told a story. So when Matt and I got together on this project, he led the artistry of it, being one of the world's greatest light painters or night photographers. We did all this at night. And, you know, I found a lot of the vehicles, some we found together. And the adventures, well, there was quite a few adventures, you might say, going out into the middle of the Everglades at night. So
no, these were looking through a lot of these photographs. Yes, you take them mostly at night. Some of them seem to be just before dawn or dusk, but mostly at night. They are beautifully lit. Help me understand. I know that you know you had the photographer working on it, but the process of getting these photographs took hours.
Yeah.
This wasn't just a hey, snap, here's a picture.
Yeah, well, I guess the nature of light painting, as Matt likes to describe it, is that you take all of the light out of the subject. You're in sheer darkness. And then he will begin at a segment of the subject with the background included. He's fixed on what our subject point is going to be. And then he takes literally numerous photographs covering all of that territory and then stitches them together in a long process of development. So it is sheer photography. It's all natural. But what we introduce is we light up the different aspects of the subject matter using techniques that he orchestrates. So
let's talk about some of these vehicles, because again, I think that you know, people probably have seen these things and you think nothing of it, but when you really stop to look at the photo, you realize there are a bunch of stories with all of these vehicles. One of them, you find a plane in the Everglades. Wings are gone, propeller's gone. It's a small plane. I mean, tell me a little bit about this one.
Well, that one's called Cocaine Cowboys, and we think that's what the nature of it was, that they had cleared a part of the Everglades for a landing strip and had brought in a load of probably cocaine, and given the era. We've had an embedded reporter with us who investigated and found out that the tail number of the plane doesn't match the plane, and the original owner of the plane never existed. It's a completely made-up name. But we think that they probably landed on that strip. They took the cocaine out, and it was too risky to try to salvage the plane, and it was just a nominal amount of money compared to the haul that they brought in, so they left it there.
And it's sitting there, it's rotting away, and it doesn't seem like it fits in this place, and yet it's becoming part of the place. Another one, too, that jumped out at me was school bus. You found a school bus, an entire school bus, just sitting out there.
We did. We found a school bus from the 1940s, it seems, as the 40s. And we were thinking, what was a school bus doing out there? And we were told that there were school children once upon a time out in that area. But what we figured by looking at the other vehicles nearby was that the school bus was used in a time to bring field workers out to what was once an agricultural plantation. And this area is all regrown now, and it's on in a national, I guess, Big Cypress National, it's not park, it's National Preserve,
okay,
what they call it. But we think that the school bus was a second use, and it was used to bring out migrant workers many, many years ago, and then it was someone's camper, it was signs that people lived in it. And
the photo is absolutely gorgeous because it's from the inside, and it looks as if nature is now taking the bus.
That's right.
Everything is growing within this bus now, and it's just kind of consuming it.
Well, we found that by mistake. So we have all this expensive equipment out. We're deep in there. Our vehicle is a long way away, and this downpour starts, and we're like, oh my gosh, you know, this is going to affect the equipment. So we decided to crawl inside the bus to act as shelter. And when we got inside, we noticed that all this greenery was in there. And it turned out that holes in the bus roof were actually spilling down and creating little gardens inside the bus. So we decided, well, we're inside, let's photograph this. It was a mistake.
I'm talking with Charles J. Kropke and Katia Esan. They are two of this year's Night Arts Challenge winners. Again, a yearly contest awarding artists and community leaders with money, trying to bring South Florida residents together through the arts. And by the way, you can see the full list of winners at WLRN.org. Katia, like you said, you spoke with a lot of different people in Liberty City.
Correct.
For this project. Originally, it was a documentary film, and you're now taking a lot of the extra material that you gathered, for this virtual reality project. Talking to the folks in Liberty City, you're telling the history, but you're also telling about how this community is evolving. And what do you hear from people about, what did you hear from people in all your conversations about how they feel about their history, but how they feel about the future?
Yeah. Well, as I mentioned, and I also would like to mention my partners, because of course I'm the chronicler, as Charles and I talked before the show, but I'm working with major Liberty City organizations like the historic Hampton House and the African Heritage Cultural Arts Center and Friends and Family of Liberty Square, and they are people that have memories of Liberty Square and Liberty City really being a vibrant artistic place where a lot of important community members came from, and they want this history to be known more than, you know, there are more films now about that area, Moonlight, and also there's a film by Farron Humes, short film called Liberty, but it's still not known enough, you know, the history that came out of there. Now, there is a major transformation going on right now, and everybody is watching. You know, people were saying something has to be done, things have to change, you know, there's too much gun violence, for example. But everybody's watching right now in what direction that transformation is going. And it's, aware.
One of the important characters you talk to, and we've spoken to, Dr. Enid Pigney, and she's a local leader who's worked really hard on preserving the historic Campton House. What were those conversations like?
I mean, she has lived through all of it, you know. She has integrated schools. She did the civil rights fight, you know. She was the first black president of Date Heritage Trust. She was intricate to save even the circle at the Miami River and the Hampton House and the Lemon City Cemetery. And, you know, she's fighting. She's 88 now. She just turned 88. And she won't stop fighting, you know, that the history is not forgotten.
What do you think, what do you hope your project is going to contribute in preserving that history, but also, you know, again, helping as this community evolves?
I think because it is community-led and we, you know, the community will decide themselves, you know, what are the anecdotes that will be told? What are the buildings that will be featured in the virtual reality experience? You know, where can we go inside? What are the clips that will be played there, you know? Martin Luther King, you know, in the Hampton House, you know? I mean, there's incredible archive that I think a lot of, you know, the Wolfsonian has it, you know, but that people really haven't seen. So I'm hoping that this will be a way to really bring this history to a broad audience.
Charles, these photographs, again, as beautiful as they are, the part of the story here is the fact that, you know, in a lot of cases, these abandoned cars are a problem for the Everglades. And this is part of the work you've spent so many years doing, which is Everglades. Protecting the Everglades, restoring the Everglades, educating people about the Everglades. But for you, what do you hope this project is going to accomplish in that mission of yours?
Well, I mean, secretly, even though our cars and our vehicles are the subject of our beautiful photography, Matt and I would both like to see a number of them taken out. I mean, you know, when a car deteriorates, oftentimes it still has its gas and oil in the vehicle that can leach out into critical wetlands, even a small amount of oil leakage. So we have actually been responsible for removing 7 vehicles already. We'd like to see more of them taken out.
Is it difficult getting them out?
Oh, yeah.
Who do you have to go to? How do you do that?
Well, we've had some very angry tow truck drivers so far.
Trying to get into some of these places,
exactly.
I'd imagine.
Exactly, but we have plans, and ultimately, for the ones that are the hardest to extract, we're hoping to use helicopters.
How many, by the way, did you find? How many do you think are out there?
Well, we actually have shot 80 vehicles out there. We think there's probably 200 to 300 that can be found, you know, readily within the greater Everglades system.
Now, for you, this project, I mean, taking these photographs, you're going to turn this into really a book for people.
Yes, we're looking to make a fine art book. We've been working with Trial Publishing locally. It's a fine art book publishing company located in the Design District. And it's our hope to tell the stories and show the pictures of what we've experienced and kind of relate that to people in a fine art coffee table book.
For you, I mean, looking back on this project, I mean, what was the one thing that you found most surprising or enlightening?
You know, I love the fact that every decade of Everglades exploitation or development, however you like to put it, was represented. We found a Model A Ford. You know, we found 1970s station wagons. You know, we found signs that the hippies were out there and Volkswagen, you know, vans, VW vans. You know, we found tractors and planes. You know, it's so many different vehicles representing so many different times showed how much human interference or human, you know, location
over
in the Everglades.
Over a very long period of time.
Exactly.
Katia, what is the next step for you? Where are you going next? And again, bringing this to virtual reality to everybody.
So now the technical part and the story part starts. And again, you know, since we're working with all these organizations, we already talked about forming a committee where everybody has a vote to decide, you know, what are the buildings that we're choosing, you know, what are the stories that we're telling. And then there's, of course, the whole software technical aspect where I have to also now find the right, you know, the right partners. And I'm not a tech person at all. I'm a storyteller. So I'm in awe myself because I'm like, oh my God, now I'm going to do a virtual reality piece.
Because it could be, as you said, it could be an exhibit somewhere, but you hope that one day it could be something anybody on their phone could just download
right.
it and be able
so,
to
yeah.
enjoy it. Again, Katya Ehsan and Charles J. Kropke, two of this year's Night Arts Challenge winners. You can read more about their winning projects proposals at WLRN.org. Thank you so much. And again, congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And that is our program for this Tuesday, December 3rd. Sundial is produced by Chris Remington and Alejandra Martinez. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontado is our digital director. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. And Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Zapka. And our technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. Now, coming up tomorrow, WLRN will continue to provide you full coverage from NPR of the House impeachment hearings. The coverage is expected to begin at 10 a.m. Eastern, should continue throughout the day. You can find more information on the impeachment hearings and watch live at WLRN.org. Sundial is back with another live show on Thursday. Remember, always find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Let us know what you think of the program. I always love hearing from you. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much. We'll talk to you again on Thursday.